Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we're back, and we'll kick things off with GBH's Peter Kazis and UMass Boston's Aaron O'Brien talking politics. Mass elections are 15 days away. Is anyone paying attention other than super PACs? And will an allegedly predatory mayor cost Everett a casino? Then the first of a series of two-on-one pre-primary interviews with candidates for statewide office. Democratic Attorney General candidate Maura Healey joins us in studio. Then we're all revved up. Why the racial divide and how America sees events in Ferguson? And will Michael Brown's death be a defining moment or a fleeting one?
We're going to ask you, should Barack Obama, given the situation around the world, have delayed his TF time for another day or even for the rest of his vacation? Then Shira Springer from the Boston Globe and the Little League World Series sensation, 13-year-old 70-mile-per-hour fastball pitcher Monet Davis, a girl. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back, Marjorie.
Hello, Jim.
You know, this is live. This is the real thing here. I want to be clear.
We are actually here. We're here.
We are. So he tried, listen to this quote. He tried kissing me, all slobbery. It was hard and aggressive. If you didn't read it, that's a description of Everett Mayor Carlo DeMaria, as told to the Boston Globe by one of his alleged victims. Mayor DeMaria, as you know, is facing, I assume you know, is facing sexual harassment allegations. Could these allegations derail his effort to bring a casino to a city? Joining us in Studio 3 for their read on this and many other political headlines are WGBH's senior web editor, that's Peter Kazis, and Aaron O'Brien, who's a political science professor at UMass Boston. Good to see you both again.
Great to be here.
Well, why not start with the mayor? I mean, this is one of the great stories, if you like this kind of thing. Four different women have accused the Everett mayor of sexual harassment. Two of them are women that work at a donut shop.
I'm sure, donut shot.
Yeah, I'm sure Mrs. DeMaria is very happy about this. But he has been a big promoter of Wynn's Casino in Everett. And, of course, there's another casino that Mohegan Sun wants to get built in Revere. So what do you think? Do you think this kind of – I mean, it's not political corruption, but it is kind of a upsetting story. Is it going to impact the casinos, do you think, at all?
You know, it's straight out of the Inquirer. And, you know, as much as we've had these debates over casinos, it fits the narrative perfectly, right? You know, casinos, no, this won't be corrupt. No, this won't. Oh, but now I've got a mayor who is alleged to be a serial sexual harassment sort of guy. So I think it fits with that sort of seedy underbelly. And It's also, I couldn't help but notice in that article and others, he hasn't been proven guilty yet. And that's important.
And he denies all of it, we should say. He hasn't been proven guilty. In fact, there are no charges pending, we should say.
And I was just accused. He's just accused.
Right. Given what we know about the research of who these men and women, but more often than not men, tend to target, there's lower income women, the two women at the donut shop where he had some leadership role, and women seeking out his service in office. So that's very much in keeping with not only the sexual harassment, but the hierarchy of it. So it stinks.
You know, I spent a vacation day, Marjorie still can't believe this, about a month ago, actually at a casino, a gaming commission hearing, Peter, at Bunker Hill Community College.
You wild guy.
Is this the kind, I mean, technically, I don't know what the answer is. Does this fall within the ambit of appropriate issue for it's only four members of the gaming commission because the chair has recused himself from at least the Eastern Mass decision. Is this something they can openly consider, privately consider, or not consider at all?
Well, I don't see how they can not consider it at all. You know, to me, this is all philosophically consistent. Gambling is, it could be argued, economically predatory. He is just practicing in private what he's advocating in public, being a private predator. I don't see how they can really consider this publicly. What it does say to me, though, is it just seems like every rock you lift up concerning any aspect of casino gambling, and we just see that, you know, original sin is alive and well everywhere. I mean,
Well, you know, this was, and we should say, well, you say it's economically predatory. People like Deval Patrick, who support it in the vast majority of the legislature, which supports it, and the vast majority of candidates for statewide office actually think it has an economic benefit. However, when you say, you both say it fits the storyline, yesterday, I think it was yesterday, I read the story in the Boston Globe about DeMaria, and we open up the paper today, and there's yet another story, this one about Mohegan's Sun, arguably having violated some exclusivity agreement with the people in Palmer, where they originally had a deal until it was voted down, is not a violation of law, but potentially a contractual violation. You know, in a minute, we're going to say to you, is anyone really paying attention to the statewide office races? There's a story every day of consequence on the casino front. Do you think this is ultimately going to give people buyer's remorse come November, Erin O'Brien?
Indeed, 100%. Because what it is, you don't have to be paying meta attention to every single detail. It is this steady drip of bad news stories, of stories you don't want to be associated with. And even if the Gaming Commission can't bring up sexual harassment in the fore, this kind of thing affects public opinion, which, as we know, has been trending downward over time.
Well, it's pretty much stabilized at a 10%. The Globe polls that have come out, I think the Herald polls, pretty much have a 10-point lead for the pro-casino, anti-repeal forces.
Well, and as you know, until you ask anywhere near you. Mm-hmm. And then So, and that has changed. So I think this steady drip of bad news and salacious news, right, is a problem for casinos.
So it's overall a problem for casinos. It's not necessarily because this mayor in Everett has been pushing the Wynn casino. It's going to affect Wynn versus the Mohegan Sun casino in Revere. Peter Kazis.
No, I mean, people have to realize that each side, you know, the Wynn side, the Mohegan Sun side, they have private detectives, they have forensic accountants, they have lawyers investigating each other back and forth. And as Jim pointed out, to me, it's no mistake that, you know, there's a drip on this side, so there's another drip on the other side. People are so cynical right now, and I think justifiably upset about so many things, that I'm not sure this will make that much difference.
Difference with whom? What are you saying? With whom? The Gaming Commission or with the public?
No, with the public. I think the public, I think those polls feel right to me. I think people will vote in favor of casinos as long as they're in a community that's rich enough to know they'll never be one in Wellesley.
You know, see, I think you've hit the nail on the head. Maybe you touch on this, Erin, even though you think that this drip, as you call it, Erin O'Brien from UMass Boston, is ultimately going to be the death knell for casinos. I think where Peter was going was people saying, what do you expect? It's sort of like, remember when the probation trial was going to cause the public to say, let's go burn down Beacon Hill. And in fact, I'll summarize the polls loosely. It was, well, yeah, it's pretty much what we expected, the outcome, and pretty much what we expect of politicians. Most of them are honest. Don't you think most people look at casinos and say, of course, there are going to be shenanigans of some sort. Of course, there's some law straddling. This is what the gambling business is all about, no?
The difference is public opinion on casinos is malleable. We see that time and time again in trends, where something on confidence in government, unfortunately, is not malleable. It's just solidified to ugliness, right? And so public opinion can be shifted down. No, I agree with Peter. The more affluent you are, you know, the less this becomes a problem of you. But I think the steady cloud, it's important to remember, we really, the energy for casinos came up in time of real economic downturn. And so now as we're coming out, I really do think that mass publics can step back and say, we don't want more of this. We don't need more of this.
Yeah, but if you're right about this, just one more question on this, and then we'll move on.
We wanted to make sure. I know you're very into this issue, Jim. We didn't want to push you too
The only Democratic candidate for governor who is unalterably opposed to casinos is Don Berwick. And one would argue that, and it's one of the few issues on a single health payer health care, and which is not, is current an issue in people's minds because we just had this health care reform. The casino thing is current, and he's gained virtually no traction on it. So if your analysis is right about where the people are, why are they not gravitating more to the guy who is an unmitigated opponent of casino gambling?
It's the difference between issue salience and public opinion. Is this a top five issue that people vote on in the governor's race? Maybe not. But if you ask straight up public opinion polls, they can lean against casinos.
Fair enough. And by the way, we're going to be joined by a person in the Democratic race for attorney general in about 20 minutes, who is the one of two candidates who actually opposes casinos herself.
So are you had enough on gambling now?
Okay. I have, All right, yes. Actually, Aaron, never, but for now, yes, I have.
Okay, Erin O'Brien is with us. She's from UMass Boston. Peter Cazes is WGBH's senior web editor. Well, Jim just mentioned a second ago that nobody seems to be paying any attention to the races. And how many days to the primary now?
15 days till the primary.
15 days to the primary. So are we not paying attention, Peter Cazes? I mean, we do have a big primary coming up, you know, as attorney generals, governor's races, a lot of things.
Well, most of the candidates' polls I've seen show that, only 4 to 6% of the people haven't made up their mind. I mean, when you say paying attention, I mean, that's like paying attention to, two tortoises racing. I mean, these have been, very unspectacular races.
What does that mean? What do you mean by unspectacular? How so?
I don't see any, great clash of personalities. I mean, Grossman doesn't scintillate me any more today than he did yesterday. Martha Coakley's still the nice lady she was before.
And still way ahead.
I think we're going to have to wait till a final election between Baker and whomever to have some fur fly.
But before we get to Erin O'Brien, so when you say between Baker and whoever, so you're saying that Baker and Fisher is a done deal, that Baker is going to Fisher. But you appear, despite a significant double-digit lead by Coakley, whatever suggests you think that it's not totally over for Grossman or Berwick?
I guess I'm being polite. There's always a chance for an upset. But no, I would say it's Coakley.
Are people, this 4 to 6% thing that Peter mentions, Erin, doesn't do much for me because people state a preference. And then who knows how deeply committed they are to this. It's just a feel. You know that gut thing? I hate when people do this, but I'm going to do it anyway. I sort of feel in my gut that no matter what we read in terms of data, that there's not a deep connection to this thing. And it's pretty important. There's going to be a new governor. There's going to be a new attorney general. There's going to be a new treasurer, a whole bunch of things.
Well, you're in the best of the world, both worlds. The data actually supports your gut.
It does?
Right,
how so?
It does. Yeah. In the sense that, there are these candidates, or when you dig deeper in those polls, they're not distinguishable on policy issues. People aren't seeing major differences from it. In political science, we call that rational adaptation. Why pay attention to something that you don't see real difference between these candidates? And it is true that the way we time our primary is horrific in Massachusetts.
It is horrific.
If we waited at, the political scientist in me, which is a primacy, says if we waited 3 weeks after Labor Day, you might see some changes. I'm guessing you probably wouldn't, but I do think those numbers would close somewhat because people have the time and the energy to pay attention. Post-Labor Day, PAC spending, all this stuff really picks up. Post-Labor Day, you run your soft spots pre-Labor Day, and then you start hitting post-Labor Day.
8 days from Labor Day. When you get back to work on that Tuesday, it's 7 days. I agree with you
and
completely.
Who does advantage? It advantages traditional in-party candidates and makes it even harder for outsiders to pay attention. And most citizens of the Commonwealth do want change in the abstract, but structurally we set up our elections that make that very hard to see through.
Peter has raised his hand. We'll recognize you. Peter Cazes over there. Take it away.
Teacher. I'll tell you, the one I would say there's a sort of an exception or a half exception, if there can be such a thing here, and that's Martha Coakley, and that's women for Martha Coakley. My anecdotal experience is that almost every woman I know is voting for Martha Coakley. Few were like really enthusiastic, but they are unwavering in their support. They're voting for her, I assume. They'll say because she's a woman, because of gender, because she's served her time. And I think that if she does get the nomination, as she most likely will, this is going to be a big problem for Charlie Baker.
Well, don't you think partly, too, is because she got beat by Scott Brown, and there's a lot of feeling that she really deserves it this time around?
A couple of weeks ago, I would have said yes. I don't think so. I think this is, by the way, I applaud women for doing this. This is like Catholics who voted for Kennedy, African-Americans who voted for Obama. This is an identity thing, and it makes a lot of sense. I mean, Martha Coakley is a very competent prominent person. And for women to want to support her, it makes a lot of sense.
And we've never had a woman governor, except for one that was the accidental governor, Jane Swift.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, the research on women in politics says women are more likely to vote for women. But it's not in the top two. They vote on policy first, and then they vote party, and then they vote gender. Now, whether Martha Coakley is an exception to this is certainly worth pointing out or worth researching. But it's not straight identity politics. It might play in part. And we're not going to – there's also a big difference between, you know, abstract – you know, I support her in the abstract because, you know, our record in Massachusetts is abhorrent for electing women. But getting, as Peter said, the money, really getting behind her, turning out, being at the rallies, putting your signs out, while they might be supporting her, I don't know how intense that support is.
Well, I think she's everyone's favorite sister-in-law. You know, they really like her, you know.
She brings wine.
Yeah. I mean, and Grossman just has not – he's a great salesman, but he just has not been able to find any meaningful difference.
And no one seems to think here that the great support that Grossman has among the grassroots is going to matter, even though primary voters tend to be very committed voters mm-hmm. like the grassroots.
You know, it is really interesting. Martha Coakley has become a self-fulfilling prophecy for getting out of the primary. But then there's all that, but can she win the real one? So it's like she's inevitable for one, but then we don't know. That's an interesting tease.
You know, Aaron, you said a couple of minutes ago that with, and I'm paraphrasing, so you'll correct me if I'm wrong, Aaron O'Brien from U.S. Boston, that there's no major differences. I assume you mean in the minds of the public.
Correct.
Because, you know, obviously Fisher, Mark yes. Fisher and Charlie Baker couldn't be any more different. Berwick and Coakley on one hand and Coakley and Grossman on the other on issues I mentioned, single payer and casinos, obviously are dramatically different. I continue to be amazed as we wait to find out what happens from this canceled board meeting at Market Basket. If you had said to me when this started in the first week, we knew right away this was history being made. Mm-hmm. Never had workers risen up in support of a boss. If I was running for statewide office, I would have glued myself yep. to these 49-year mm-hmm. employees who started at 14 years old. I'd be at every Market Basket thing. I'd be screaming in mm-hmm. support of R13. I'm not taking sides this moment, even though I think people know where my loyalties are. What, is this not a huge missed opportunity for the gubernatorial candidates? And by the way, everybody has said something, but nobody has glommed on, at least in my mind, like I thought they would.
And it speaks in part to what Peter is saying. This is a daft group, right? We're not particularly excited by them, in part because they're not showing up there. You've got working class people. You've got really diverse working class people talking about issues of financial insecurity and loyalty and job loss. Hell, I'll go. Right? You know, like that's a lot better. And they are not able to connect there. It's like politics 101 they're missing. I agree 100%.
Well, especially, let me interrupt you and say, because most would argue that a master politician in this state, Deval Patrick, told us, what, 5 weeks ago, four weeks ago, he would absolutely not get involved. And then, obviously, he realized where the political winds were. And Maggie Hassan, the governor of New Hampshire, and he have been all over this thing nonstop.
Well, it's also a lot of jobs beyond the political winds.
Yeah.
I mean,
of course.
It's a big deal.
Someone should be pledging to invest, you know, the state pension funds.
Amen.
In Market Basket. And by the way, as a taxpayer, I think most people would approve of that.
But there was speculation that part of the reason a lot of the Democrats weren't involved is because Market Basket is non-union and that they might pay some price in their support from union workers and union money.
Look, these days, there is a total lack of political imagination in this state. I mean, it is really shocking. I mean, this is something that could be in the history books. Workers striking on behalf of management? Come on.
You know, it's one of these things. Remember that Shannon O'Brien made that joke that I thought was funny at the time in the debate with Mitt Romney about, do you want to see my tattoo? One of these candidates should have MB tattooed onto their limbs and be showing it to absolutely everybody.
I think Martha Coakley should be the one to lead the charge on that. Don't you think the
we'll
attorney general should get
in.
A little tattoo, maybe like on her neck so we could actually see it.
You know,
maybe on her shoulder.
Speaking of the attorney general, one of the most interesting stories stories I read, and most appalling at the same time. I'm sure you've all read the notion that already super PACs, which it perfectly legally in support of whoever the Democratic nominee are, have already raised $3.1 million to spend against the likely Republican nominee, Charlie Baker. $3.1 million. The reason I love the story, even though I hate the content because I hate all these super PAC things, is that Martha Coakley, who is the likely beneficiary of all this, has totally disavowed the super PACs. And when her spokesperson is asked, what will your position be if you're the nominee and you spend they want to spend $3.1 million on your behalf, even though technically you can't, legally you can't coordinate, her view is, I will disavow it and ask them to stop. What's your take, Erin O'Brien, on this massive amount of money? By the way, we should say Democratic governors and a bunch of unions, including the Mass Teachers Association, are behind the $3.1 million. They're not trying to hide what the source is.
You know, my first thought is this is why people hate American politics. You know, regular folks listening, myself, you can't have influence when $3.1 million is coming in. And that speaks to sort of the macro problem. In terms of, you know, Coakley's disavowing of the super PACs while, you know, being taking their money, even though I don't really know. It's like, yeah.
Well, she doesn't tell, we should be right. clear. She can't take their
she
money.
Can't.
She can't have
well,
any coordination.
That's what I mean. It's a wink, wink. It's like, you know, it's like a bad relationship where
Call
I don't want
to
see
Conley.
You. Well, I don't want to see you on Friday night, but I'll call you at, you know, midnight. That's what this feels like to me when no one's around.
Is anybody, you know, every time we have one of these discussions, I'm glad to hear Erin say what she says, Peter Kadzis, but the sense I get, Marjorie and I have discussed this ad nauseum for years, is the vast majority of the public, you say it's why they hate American politics. My sense is that people aren't outraged enough about this. If they were, the Supreme Court of the United States would figure out how to weasel out of Citizens United, the case that made a lot of this possible.
Listen, super PACs are the only hope voters have to be entertained by the wildly inaccurate attack ads that make elections worth having.
That's true.
Come on.
But the public opinion, that if you poll Americans, we know there's hyper-polarization. They actually do agree that they hate this much money in politics.
Yeah, but do you know what they also say? That somewhere between 80 and 90% make their decision based upon ads they see on television. Despite all the debates, all the campaigning,
right,
all the grassroots stuff, TV ads, particularly negative ads, sadly,
ambivalence
help determine
is real.
Elections. Yeah, exactly.
And I think people aren't wild on financing them with taxpayer
yes.
dollars either. We're talking with Erin O'Brien from UMass Boston, Peter Kadzis, WGBH senior web editor. Can we move on to Scott
sure.
Brown? Because I love talking about Scott Brown. Okay, he's running, of course, for Senate up in New Hampshire against Jeanne Shaheen. He had been behind last month by 12 points. Now, in new polling, he's 2 points behind. Jeanne Shaheen is up only 2 points, I should say, over Scott Brown. So it's absolutely fantastic. And apparently, according to the pollster, one of the reasons that Scott Brown is doing so well is because of the unpopularity of Barack Obama.
And obviously Scott Brown knows this. Here's a little sound from Tamara Keith's reporting. Former Mass Senator Scott Brown links Senator Jeanne Shaheen to who? Barack Obama.
Anybody would be better than President Obama. And I know that he's not up for re-election. I know you're shocked to hear that.
Amen. Yeah.
But guess what? His number one foot soldier is Senator Shaheen. She's up for re-election.
So what do you think, Peter Kadzis? Do you think that Jeanne Shaheen has been very popular up in her state, even among conservatives, because they think she's done a good job for the state? But Scott Brown seems to be launching a serious challenge here.
Well, I think anyone who thought he wouldn't was a little cuckoo. You know, Massachusetts has this love-hate relationship with Scott Brown. And, you know, first we were saying he didn't have the guts to get in the race. Then he got in the race. Then we said he didn't stand a chance. Things are now about even. You know, the presidential votes in New Hampshire are usually pretty tight between the Democrats and the Republicans. So I'm not surprised. Will he win? You know, too hard to say. His personal favorability ratings are not particularly high. As Jim said, he's riding the anti-Obama wave. Now, for Jeanne Shaheen, how much bigger will that anti-Obama wave get to be? I mean, I think this will be a close election. I think Jeanne Shaheen will probably win.
Let me read you a line, Erin O'Brien, following up on what Peter Kadzis just said from Politico, which shows in my opinion, how the Democrats in Washington must be quaking because of these numbers, not because Brown might defeat Shaheen, but because of the impact of Barack Obama's numbers. Here's from Politico.com. The closeness of the race is all the more stunning when you consider that Brown remains slightly underwater on personal favorability. Overall, he's viewed positively by 35% and negatively by 38% of those polled. So he has closed a, what is it, 12-point gap, you said, Marjorie?
12 points.
To two in a short period of time, despite the fact that people in New Hampshire apparently view him negatively. It's all about Barack Obama, which is a terrifying thought for Democrats who are running in tight races around the country, no?
Especially likable Republican challengers, right? You know, if he's this far. I mean, it is pretty amazing. If he loses, he'll be the first potential senator to lose to two female candidates in a general election. But
if he wins, how many people have been elected to the U.S. Senate from two states? It's like two or one or something.
Yeah, it has happened. It's
Trivial Pursuit, right? Yeah, but I think that the unfavorable numbers and that he's closed that gap is absolutely stunning. You know, to political watchers. And it really, I mean, I'm repeating a little bit, but the idea that Barack Obama can bring down someone who is so favorably viewed, and prior to this very smart attack on Scott Brown's part, Shaheen was viewed as someone who would sometimes stand up to Barack Obama. So, you know, he's really bringing candidates down.
A big part of me would like to see the Democratic Party stand by Obama. I mean, the Democrats, to me, are a bunch of, you know, whimpering, simmering cowards. You know, Obama has his shortcomings, that's for sure. But, I mean, the party is so wishy-washy in standing behind him. You don't have to like the guy. You just stand behind him. And I'm not sure the Democrats would be in the pickle they're in if they showed more support for Obama.
You know what I wonder, too? That earlier this year, the Globe had a series about Obamacare, so-called, up in New Hampshire, talking about how people that had hospitals nearby and doctors nearby, suddenly because their new health plans did not allow them to go to those same doctors and same hospitals, are driving like 65 miles over the White Mountains to get to their doctors. It was a pretty damning report on the effects of the changes in healthcare up in New Hampshire. And you wonder if that is a big deal. You know,
it's the difference between a really good personal story and what the data shows. And the data shows that Obamacare, despite obvious rollout problems and things like that, more people are getting coverage and they're happier with their coverage. But as soon as you can pull out these one, you know, and more than one probably, but these really, you know, sort of egregious of examples of people you find sympathetic, you know, no one wants to drive 65 miles to a doctor. That story resonates a lot more. But to Peter's point, Obama hasn't made that sale, and the Democrats haven't stood behind him to make that sale. So everyone's jumping ship and not really standing behind a signature piece of legislation. So those exact stories and things like that really resonate.
By the way, the Associated Press just announced seconds ago that Gene Sheen has called for the impeachment of Barack Obama. Well, maybe not, but I mean, so what does she, in a serious moment, what does she do? I mean, does she all of a sudden, as Marjorie said, she has stood up to the president as if that's a badge of honor, but I guess it is in American politics now. And I guess it should be. If it's an issue of conscience, you should obviously do what you believe in, not just what the leader of your party and the president says to do. What does she do to reverse this trend unless all of a sudden Barack Obama catches you-know-what in a bottle and improves his numbers dramatically prior to an event? We're only, what is it, three months away? 2.5 months away from midterm elections.
Attack ads.
Attack ads against who? Scott Brown?
Against Scott Brown. And he's eminently vulnerable on that. The New Hampshire electorate is pretty commonsensical. And if you can point out, you know, the issues such as his craziness on Obamacare, his being soft on financial regulation, I think if Elizabeth Warren could beat him, she can beat him.
Yeah, you make it about Scott Brown. It's about Scott Brown. You say, you know,
Scott
New Hampshire,
Brown, the carpetbagger.
Yeah.
I mean,
no, and there's good numbers in this political poll for her.
Yeah, even though, say what? Like what?
The unfavorables. Mm-hmm. You know, that means you've got your attack laid out for you. Of course, she doesn't want to see the numbers closing, but with those numbers closing against what people in New Hampshire view as a generally unlikable candidate with those unfavorables, that means you make this race about you and him, you and him. And when he brings up Obama, Sir Barack Obama's not in this room. Barack Obama doesn't live in New Hampshire.
And Jean Shaheen is supposed to be a really tough campaigner. Mm-hmm. She and her husband have long history and long we have one of our favorite emailers, or an email that Christopher from New Hampshire, who's a Republican, emails us all the time. And he talks about their roots and how much goodwill there is toward the Shaheens as a couple.
Again, I wouldn't – Democrats don't have any reason to panic, and Republicans don't have any reason to rejoice. This is the race is reaching a sort of equilibrium here, and it really doesn't begin until after Labor Day.
You know, speaking of federal candidates, we weren't going to bring this up, but I can't resist because it's a story that is putting me totally over the edge. Both the New York Times and the Boston Globe, and I assume other papers this week, have written stories about members of Congress who are living in their offices.
I love this story.
In Washington. And apparently...
Jim, they're not living in their offices. They're squatting.
They're squatting in their offices. Right. Now, the theory behind this is long-term Republican senator, and somebody who's pretty deeply respected by everybody on both sides of the aisle, Richard Lugar, lost in the Republican primary because he lived in D.C. and he was only renting a room back in his district. And keep in mind, these guys make, and I know it's going to admit guys and women, people are going to say it's a lot of money, $174,000. It's, I would argue, not that much money when you have to maintain two residences, but that's not why these people are living in their offices. They're living in their offices so they can show how frugal and tough. It's yet another example of the complete unraveling mm-hmm. of common sense in American politics. By the way, for those who are saying they can't afford it, there are tons of members of Mike Capuano is a good example. Mm-hmm. He used to live with Anthony Weiner and a whole bunch of other members of Congress, just like college kids, mm-hmm. who roomed together to save money. What was your reaction to this so-called squatting, living in their office story?
Well, A, I don't want to vote for that person if they're not smart enough to get an apartment, right, with a roommate. And I think voters are smarter than this. Yes, you want to maintain ties to your district, but we also want to get rid of this hyper-partisanship. And part of the reason you do that is if you actually socialize with these folks once in a while.
Do you know that they don't even have showers in the building?
Wait a minute. They have to go to the gym to take a shower? But they also,
don't forget, they have
hair salons, and they have places to get your nails done, and they have dry cleaners. Yeah. I mean, they got a whole little
city. Let's look at their hotel bills. I guarantee they're living in their office, but if you looked at their hotels, they're also spending some money on Orbitz.
I don't know. Back in my 20s, I lived for 6 months in an apartment, and I never had the electricity turned on.
What, are you bragging about that, or what?
It made a lot of sense. I was never there.
Money was tight.
I was never there. Or, you know, when I had a flashlight. Good luck to these ladies. Good for them.
I kind of like it myself. Yeah, I kind of think it's a fun thing, Jim. You're being too
critical. Why don't you sleep in the newsroom tonight and see how you feel about it?
Except for the interns are bringing their food. The LAs are spending time doing this kind of stuff now.
Okay, last thing before we let you go. We're going to talk about this with our listeners in the second hour. I don't want to get into the whole vacation issue because I'm sort of tired of that for presidents. I would argue the most stressful job in the world every day. And the notion that they ever get away from work is just the more they're away from, at least have some peace and relaxation amidst the work. The one exception, I think, to this rule, Peter Kadza, starting with you, is Barack Obama's taken a huge amount of heat about giving this passionate speech about the beheading of this New Hampshire reporter by ISIS, or ISIL, as the president chooses to call them. And then immediately after this passionate pronouncement from the vineyard, I don't mean that sarcastically, but it was very passionate and powerful, I thought. He's immediately off to the golf course. We see these photographs of him smiling broadly. He loves golf, that sort of thing. And of course, we read minutes later, I think a British website mentioned that when David Cameron, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, heard about the beheading, he immediately not only didn't play golf, canceled his vacation and went back to, was it 10 Downing or whatever, wherever the Prime Minister lives or hangs out. What was your reaction? Is this just overreaction to what is called optics, or was this symbolically a pretty horrible decision by the president?
Geez, I'm the first one to say Obama's made a horrible decision, but I don't think this is one. I really think that this is this type of criticism. Look, when George Bush gave up golf in the middle of Iraq and Afghanistan, the press managed to turn his giving up golf around to be some sort of negative. I really think this is passive-aggressive behavior on the part of the media trying to cut the president down to size.
By the way, it's not just conservative media. There are a lot of liberals in the press who are equally upset.
I mean, particularly liberals. It's like their husbands or wives, you know, are on them because they're not spending enough time with the kids. So we're going to deny Obama his golf game. I mean, really, Dwight Eisenhower was a pretty good president. He played a lot of golf.
How about you, Erin O'Brien?
You know, I'm with you on the general vacation thing, but I actually think this is a fumble. Like, you know, at least be smart enough to have photographers on the golf course if you're going to do it. I mean, I feel like this administration on these sort of basic optic things, if it's, you know, if it's fourth and long, they connect. But if it's second in inches, they fumble. And this is a basic, basic thing. This is a this isn't a normal story. This is a beheading of an American citizen who was a journalist. And you did give a moving speech. Don't undercut it being all smiles. Go golf, maybe. But wait a day. On the general stuff, yes, I want you rested. Yes, I want you a slight vacation for a couple hours. That's good for us. But this one was a mistake.
But just one last thing on this. You know, this reminds me, and not to at all belittle this awful, awful situation, for especially with a man with local roots. But this reminds me of the height of hypocrisy of the flag pin. You know, Barack Obama's been big on not playing into the appearance, you know, political appearances, you know, the appearance kind of way to court favor. And part of me thinks, I like the fact that he's not doing that, because what is he supposed to do? Go into his house after the speech and be inside with his family? Everybody's supposed to be sad and depressed all day long? Well, maybe you think that. I think it's rather hypocritical because he's not going to be – well, but what does that mean? Does that mean he's doing what people think he should do to play into that appearance thing?
Well, let me tell you John Kennedy's story. Shortly after Kennedy went in the White House, he took off for an afternoon with his buddies and they went to play golf. He got a hole in one, and he said he'd fire anyone who told anyone about his hole in one, because he knew, coming off a president who was a golf player. I'm not saying Obama is the smartest political cat. I just don't join in the condemnation.
Okay, thank you very much for being here, both of you guys, today. Erin O'Brien is a professor of political science at UMass Boston. Peter Kazis is WGBH's senior web editor. You can keep up with him on the political podcast, The Scrum, which you can find at iTunes or at blogs.wgbh.org/scrum.
They're both leaving to play golf, by the way. Four out of both of you.
Have a good match. Peter and Erin, great to have you here, as always. Thank you very much. Up next, we continue our final round of interviews with the candidates before the September 9th primaries. Maura Healey is seeking the Democratic nomination for Attorney General. She joins us on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Ginn. Yes, we are live back from vacation. We're kicking off our final round of interviews with statewide candidates before the September 19th primaries. Here with us in Studio 3 is Maura Healey. Maura is running for Attorney General on the Democratic side. Maura, good to see you.
Great to be here, Jim. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much for coming in. Maura, let's start with this whole Teamsters brouhaha. This was the local Teamsters 25. They were in a little hot water when they were accused of threatening and harassing the top chef, cast, and crew, throwing homophobic slurs and sexist and racist slurs. They were upset because they were not union drivers driving these people around. These were production assistants. I know you said that the Teamsters have been, and they're supporting you. They're strong for civil rights, families, LGBT stuff. But I didn't hear, and maybe I missed it, the essential question. Should the Teamsters, I mean, should these people from Top Chef be required to hire union drivers from the local, as opposed to having production assistants drive them around while they're filming in Milton?
Well, I mean, what I think, look, I'm a huge supporter of unionization and what unions have done for this country. I'm the daughter of two union members. My mom was a nurse, my dad a teacher. So I really appreciate what unions have done, particularly for middle class families in our country. When it comes to this issue, though, you know, my comment about it was this. And again, Margie, I'm just going by what was reported in the paper. To the extent there were racist or homophobic comments made, sexist comments made, there's absolutely no place for that. You and I know that. And we got to speak out about it. And I've addressed it with Teamsters. I understand they deny it. And, you know, any instance of that kind of discriminatory, hateful commentary or conduct, right, we've got to take on. And I say that as somebody who led the Civil Rights Division in the Attorney General's office and worked to combat hate crimes. That's really important. I also know from my own experience with Teamsters, you know, I went to their benefits earlier this year. They do a lot of work on behalf of kids with disabilities. Yeah. They have a truck in the Pride Parade,
right,
which is really something. And so I know what they stand for and value as a union, and that's why I'm glad to have their support. But, you know, I think it was an unfortunate, absolutely incident, what's alleged, and I have no doubt that, you know, the appropriate people will be held accountable if it's true.
But should they have to hire these drivers? If they're saying they're saving a lot of money, hiring production assistants, drive people around. The union says, and by the way, I left out the allegations that the tires of 14 cars were slashed as well. Should they have to hire Teamsters drivers?
Well, I would hope they would hire Teamsters drivers. I would hope that they would support unions. I think, again, that's really important to, you know, to our economy and the health and well-being of working families here in the state. And that's, you know, that's my position on it, Marjorie.
Casinos. We're talking to Maura Healey, by the way, who's one of the two Democrats who wants to be your attorney general. Everybody is praising the quality of the race between you and Tolman, Warren Tolman. Warren will be here later this week. Two really high-quality candidates. That there are not many substantive differences. One clear difference is you support repeal of the casino law. Warren Tolman does not. Charlie Baker the other day, who says he will vote against repeal, said if he's elected governor and people vote for repeal, he would at least consider a new law that would allow Springfield to have its casino. And I'll paraphrase what Charlie said. It's in great economic need. I haven't heard, I don't know if he has anybody else with a great plan to rejuvenate downtown Springfield. Even though you support repeal, would you be open to a single casino, meaning in Springfield, to at least address their issues, their economic issues, Maura Healey?
You know, my view on this, Jim, is that I just don't think casinos are the answer economically, even in a place like Springfield. And I spent a lot of time there on this campaign, including two events last week when I was out there. And I talked to a lot of folks. They are hurting. Unemployment is 9% above state average. We've got a disproportionate number of folks out there who are on social services right now and relying on social services. And so things are really out of line when it comes to disparities between and among communities here. So that's, you know, I recognize the issue. I got to say, though, Jim, I really think that casinos are bad for the economy. Look at what's happening down in Atlantic City right now. You've got 8,000 people turning to church pews praying because they've just been laid off by casino operators. And, you know, I think we've got to have a longer-term view. We can do better here.
But the people of Springfield would say to that, we respect your – I'm speaking for them. They haven't authorized me, but I'll speak for them anyway. We hear you, Maura Healey. We've considered the issues. We voted in favor of it. We believe it's a boon for our economy. So please tell us, if you don't want us to have a casino – because you want people to repeal the law, tell us what else you're going to give us that's going to help fix our economy better than you think the casino we support will do.
Well, I think when it comes to that vote, it was a very low turnout for that vote in Springfield in the first place. But the second, and I think
would you take the nomination if it was a very low turnout against Warren Tolman if you beat him by one vote?
Hey, touche.
Thank you
good,
very
Jim.
Much. I was waiting for that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Maura.
No, but in all seriousness, when it comes to this issue, you know, and I talked to a lot of folks in Springfield, what they want jobs, they want investment in infrastructure, education. I think there are a lot of things that we could be doing and creating out there. There's a new manufacturing facility going in there. And I think that there are lots of ways we can employ even low-wage, not as highly educated workers out there. And that's what I'm going to advocate for. But, you know, on this issue, Jim, as Attorney General, I'll tell you this. November, we're going to see a vote. And if we see gaming going forward, it is really important that we have somebody as Attorney General who's an independent regulator in the industry. And I'm the only candidate in this race who I think can say that. I've been a consumer advocate. My opponent, Warren Tolman, and I stand in very different places on this issue, but I think I bring the experience as a prosecutor, as a consumer advocate, and also the independence from the industry that's absolutely necessary and critical if you're going to be attorney general in this state with that as the single largest consumer issue coming down the pike.
We're talking to Maura Healey, who's running for Attorney General on the Democratic ticket. You know, we talked with a couple of minutes ago with our political panel about the travails of the mayor of Everett, who has been accused by four different women of sexual harassment. He has been a big proponent of the Everett casino proposal. And, of course, that's one in the Boston area. The other one is in Mohegan Sun and Revere. So what do you think, Maura? You're a politician. You've been out there. You think getting accused by four different women is going to, and you're the mayor of the city that's really pushing for this casino, is going to affect people's vote when they come to vote on the casino ballot in November?
Well, look, Margie, I'm just going to speak from what I've read in the paper and the allegations, which I find, frankly, disgusting.
Yeah,
I just find
the
gross.
Slobbery kiss and, allegation and, was particularly disgusting, I thought.
Well, you know, and this is this it, the allegations are beyond just sort of sexual harassment. I mean, we're talking about alleged criminal activity, sexual assault and battery, candidly. And we're talking about potential issues of corruption when it comes to trading sexual favors for actions by an elected official. So, you know, that's something that should be investigated and looked at. And there's no place for that. You know, as somebody, as I say, who was a civil rights lawyer, I find that that kind of behavior, if true, absolutely more than just troubling, but disgusting.
You know, I hesitate to ask this question, but I'm going to ask this question, but tell you, you may not say how much you love meeting people in all 351 cities and towns. Is that a deal?
Oh, but I do.
Is that a deal?
Okay, okay.
Yeah, you know, one of the differences, I am not one who says when someone's a politician that it's a pejorative. A politician, it's an honorable profession if you behave honorably. Your opponent has pretty much been a politician much of his life, Warren Tolman. You have not run for elective office. You've been a lawyer and a public-private sector kind of thing. How hard is this? I'm serious. How hard is this campaigning thing for you? You're used to operating in a totally different venue, making your case to a man or woman in front of a courtroom or a judge or to panels of people, that sort of thing. How hard is this campaigning thing for you, honestly?
You know, it's been easy, actually, in many respects, Jim. I mean, sure, it's tiring and long days on the road, but it's been wonderful. And, you know, my job in the Attorney General's office, particularly as a leader in that office, I was regularly out meeting with the public, meeting with community groups and organizations, talking about issues, traveling around the state. So that's not a new exercise to me. But I found it incredibly energizing. I've loved campaigning. I've loved getting out and talking to people and listening to them. And right now, I think we've seen the benefit of all that. There's tremendous energy and momentum for this campaign and for my race. People really are excited and fired up. And that's certainly buoyed me and carried me along. And I think, you know, in terms of the Attorney General's office itself, I think that this, you know, Jim, is an office that where people really want somebody who's going to be the people's lawyer. They're not looking for another Beacon Hill politician.
Well, speaking of people's lawyer, the current people's lawyer, your boss, Martha Coakley, who's running for governor, has been criticized roundly for a deal she struck with a former state senator, Jack Brennan, who, in the spirit of full disclosure, I talk to every few weeks at Whole Foods in Cambridge, where I happen to bump into him, who was a lobbyist, his firm was, for Franciscan. And he had a deal with them where he would get a commission, a percentage of what the hospital got from the state legislature.
Yeah, $370,000 he collected. $370,000 from the Franciscan Hospital for Children. And Martha Coakley's office said that was these were improper lobbying fees. And the settlement she reached.
Violation of law, correct?
Yes. Yes. And the settlement she reached, they were allowed to say not to admit any guilt, to repay $100,000 of the $370,000, and not basically let off the hook for any further criminal or civil liability. And do you think that that was a good deal? Would you have done the same thing?
I've commented on this, that I don't think that the deal went far enough. You know, here's a situation where you have a lobbyist collecting a contingency fees. You know, contingency fees are illegal, and there's a reason they're illegal. There shouldn't be bounties on what people are able to recover for groups or organizations by friendships and relationships on Beacon Hill. And I think the public knows that and gets that. There's no place for it. So that's what happened here. It was wrong. And, you know, I find it particularly troubling when you're talking about an organization that's really there to serve needy kids.
Yeah.
And here's this guy taking this extravagant cut. So I have a real problem with that. And, you know, I think, you know, for the public, too many are going to view it as business as usual, politics as usual. And one of the things I bring to this race as Attorney General is an independence from all of that, and certainly a willingness to stand up and take on special interests and hold people accountable, because the public deserves better than this.
So what would have been a more reasonable deal? Bill Galvin, the Secretary of State, is going after them, going after this Brennan Group yet again.
Well, and I'm glad to see that. And look, I know this was a criminal prosecution, and there were, you know, issues related to the criminal prosecution and statute of limitations and the like. But I would like to have seen more money come back, because, again, contingency fees are illegal, plain and simple. And, you know, this guy, he knew better. He knew better and shouldn't have been doing business this way.
When you criticize your former boss, as you're doing here, at least her behavior, her decision making, do you speak to her? Do you call Martha Coakley? Or I'm serious about this. I mean, you have a long relationship with her. Do you call the Attorney General and say, hey, Martha, I just want to give you a heads up on this Brennan thing. I'm going to not be with you on the casino thing. I'm not going to be. And I'm serious. I don't mean this in any critical way. Do you do that as a prelude to publicly differing from her or no?
Well, we haven't spoken about the Brennan matter at all. But as a general matter, you know, I have we have a terrific relationship, personal and professional, and I have a great deal of respect and regard for the Attorney General. She's been an Attorney General that's really led, not just here in Massachusetts, but really made her mark nationally, and that office has made its mark nationally. And I'm proud of my work in that office the last 7 years and some of the things that we worked on together.
You were the lawyer in the Defense of Marriage Act, speaking
yeah,
of the
I argued and won the country's first successful challenge to defeat DOMA. I led a lot of the work around predatory lending practices and efforts to stop unnecessary foreclosures and the fight to protect and ensure women's access to reproductive health care in the state, which, as you know, remains a significant issue and will be an issue for our next Attorney General.
You know, we're talking with Maura Healey, who's running for the Attorney General spot. It just occurred to me, looking at you, I should ask you this. We're later on in the show going to talk about this kid, Moni Davis, this 13-year-old
I think is how you say it, but
I'm
whatever.
Sorry,
yeah.
Whatever. She's a 13-year-old kid. She's got a great fastball. She's a pitcher. She's one of the first women ever in the she's only a kid, in the Little League World Series. But she's 5'4". She's being poo-pooed because, okay, she's reached, this is as far as she's going to go. She can't do any more than this because the boys are all going to surpass her and stuff. You're 5'4", are you not?
I am.
And
well,
you went on.
5'6" today. And heels surgery.
Oh, okay,
but, right.
And you went on as quite a phenomenal little athlete when you were a kid to go on and not only play in college on a scholarship, but go on and play in the pros. So, are we poo-pooing this little kid prematurely?
Absolutely. And you know, I was so tickled to see that. Here she is. She's 13 years old. She's hurling a baseball with all boys as teammates. And you know, I've been a beneficiary of Title IX. I'm so lucky for the fights that women and generations before me fought to make available opportunities in sport. And I think it's tremendous when you see somebody like her out there playing ball. I had the benefit of those experiences. I'm thrilled to see her doing it. I was thrilled to see Becky Hammon just get hired by the NBA.
The Spurs. Antonio Spurs assistant coach. Yeah.
World
yeah.
champion San Antonio Spurs. That's terrific. You know, the other day, so you do a lot of fun things when you're campaigning. I got Bob Cousy's endorsement the other day.
I saw that.
I wore his number all through school. And we were talking
about. Did you wear his number because it was Bob Cousy's number, or it was just happenstance?
Oh, no, it was intentional.
No, meaning it was not.
No,
is that really true?
That's a true story. Now, it is true that Cousy went into the Hall of Fame the year I was born, but I was deadly serious about this stuff. So, fourth grade, I find myself on a youth association team called the Holy Cross Crusaders, and I was a huge Celtics fan, and I was a point guard, and I thought, bing. This is the number I'm going to wear. He's the greatest in the game. Played at Holy Cross, played for the Celtics, wore 14. So I was lucky to get his endorsement a couple weeks ago. And one of the things we were talking about was the advances for girls and women in sports and how important that is. When you look at the number of women who end up on corporate boards or running organizations, a lot of them, you know, gain confidence and self-esteem through participation in sports. And so I just think that's great. Anytime people are breaking barriers and shattering glass ceilings. I think it's great.
By the way, I should just say I stole the ball from Maura on the hall before the interview. She was
I
dribbling
saw her
down
on
the
your
hall
show doing. What do you call that when you twist the basketball on your finger?
Oh, Jim made me
do
that.
I saw
spinning
that on TV.
It.
Spinning it was very, very impressive. Yeah. But you must have given some thought to this, having been a professional basketball player. You know, this little girl is playing and traditionally boys mm-hmm. sport baseball. Girls end up in softball teams most of the time. Nobody really watches much professional sports involving women unless it's in the Olympics when it's beach volleyball and they're all in bikinis, you know, out there. That's a big hit. So why do you think that is? Why doesn't women's basketball, women's soccer, why doesn't get the kind of excitement that men's sports does?
Well, we got to change that. And it was great to see her on the cover of Sports Illustrated.
It was.
You know, look, we've got the Boston Breakers, a terrific women's soccer team here. We've got teams in the WNBA playing now. You know, I think, Marjorie, that more and more people, they kind of get turned off by some of what they see going on in the men's professional games.
Uh-huh.
And I think more and more people are starting to get out and see women play. I certainly encourage it. I think it's a great take.
Can we talk about a couple of men for a second?
Sorry, I just was on a little tangent there about women in sports, Jim.
That's fine.
I'm
into
it. Politics.
Let's talk about the, well, this is business, actually. Let's talk about the Demoulases, the cousins. This is another place where there appears to be a divide between you and Warren Tolman. In an article I read in Mass Live, masslive.com, Warren says this is about leadership. It's about standing up and going to these people and saying, look, you've got to get together. We've got to put pressure internally as well as externally on these folks to cut a deal. And then you were quoted as saying, I don't know what we want an attorney general, that we want an attorney general who's going to show up on people's doorsteps. Usually we do that when we have a subpoena in hand. Again, your boss did a fairly high profile thing, created an 800 number, a toll free number. I don't know if it was 800, where if people were fired, they could call and find out what their rights were, those sort of things. You seem to be more in that camp than the camp of those who believe that there should be active involvement, active leadership, bully pulpit involvement on the part of statewide elected officials. Why?
Well, I actually do think that there should be active involvement on the part of state officials, including the Attorney General's office and the Attorney General. And I support the outreach that's been made, some of it behind closed doors, some of it public.
What did you mean then when you said we shouldn't be going to their door? It sounds to me like you're saying exactly the opposite.
Well, the context of this was this. My opponent was on basically discrediting the work of the governor and his efforts to reach out to the family to and investors to broker a deal. And, you know, I just don't think this is another place for I'm going to do this better than you. I'm going to outdo you on this. I mean, everybody knows that the governor and the attorney general have been reaching out now for weeks on this. And he made the comment, I think it was here on another show, that he was going to, you know, knock on Arthur T's door and knock on Arthur F's door and kind of the, you know, here I am, save the day. And my comment was simply, like, you got to be measured and thoughtful about these things as you go. Of course, we're going to reach out and try to broker a deal. And that's what's happening now. But
the Attorney General didn't do that. You said the Attorney General and the governor. The governor originally told us he wouldn't get involved on this show, and then he did. But the Attorney General, to my understanding, is basically, I don't mean to poo-poo what she did at all, but said we'll provide this service through this toll-free number for people who either fired or worried about getting fired. But she didn't do what you're describing you think the Attorney General or a governor should do, did she?
Oh, I understand that she did, actually. Reach out.
Mm-hmm.
Reach out. But I think you got to do both, Jim. I think, you know, you need to be willing to reach out and try to bring about a resolution, which I understand both she and the governor have been doing. But you also got to be there to do things like enforce fair labor laws and make sure that employees and their families understand the law. And that's why it's important to set up things like a hotline. Give them a resource in the Attorney General's office, the people's law firm, for them to turn to. So, you know, I think you got to do both. And I sure had hoped that we'd wake up this morning and read that there was a deal. Doesn't look like it's happened yet. But, you know, every day that goes by, it's killing customers. It's killing workers. It's killing
small
suppliers.
Vendors. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, I was out in Western Mass a week ago. And, you know, there are people that can't sell their corn.
I know. It's the whole thing is really sad. Let's turn to one other thing involving your boss, the Attorney General Martha Coakley. She took some criticism 2 weeks ago in this Partners Healthcare deal where she agreed to this expansion of Partners down to three other hospitals, and critics, Leahy Clinic, including some other competitors of Partners, have said this is going to be terrible. It's going to raise rates. It's going to be terrible for Massachusetts. Would you have reached that same agreement with Partners? Were you the Attorney General today?
Well, you know, here's where I come from on this. I was in the office and oversaw some of that earlier part of the investigation into this. Also oversaw some of the reports prepared by the Attorney General's office relating to costs and what was contributing to increases in costs. And I think that sort of transparency has been very important in the reporting done by the AG's office. You know, looking here, here's where I come down, Marjorie, on this. It is clear that we've got we've done a decent job when it comes to accessibility for care and quality of care here in the state. But we need to do a lot more to bring down costs and really exert a downward pressure on costs. And that means holding people's feet to the fire. Now, this agreement, you know, it's before the court right now. There are some caps. There are some terms there. There are some breaks in contracting arrangements laid out. And I think we just need to look really carefully and make sure that we're getting everything that we can out of this deal right now. I know as Attorney General, and this will be the job of the next Attorney General, I will be doing everything I can to exert downward pressure on costs. And that means, you know, bringing hospitals and insurance companies to the table.
Before you leave, Maura Healey, in 30 seconds, why you rather than Warren Thoman?
Well, you know, Jim, this is the only job I've ever run for. I'm a lawyer, and I've been in charge of half of the Attorney General's office, 250 of the 500 lawyers and staff there. I also come with experience as a civil rights attorney, as a prosecutor, and was a litigator in private practice for many years. And I think that's what separates me from my opponent, who comes out of an experience on Beacon Hill, the legislature, you know, a political experience. And, you know, I'm the person who's tried cases and made investigations. He hasn't. I'm the person who's led and argued and won on big matters like DOMA, on predatory lending, on keeping families in their homes, on achieving nationwide settlements for kids with disabilities, and on fighting for women's access to reproductive health care. So I think, you know, for me, this is – I bring the experience. I also bring the track record and the relevant experience in that office. I also think, you know, we're in a time right now, whether it's Everett, whether it's casinos – my opponent and I stand in very different places on these issues, and I think it's more important than ever that we have somebody as Attorney General there to fight for people, not for lobbyists, not for Beacon Hill, who can really bring an independence to that position.
Maura
Healey,
thank you
very much for coming in, and good luck in the race. Maura Healey is a Democrat running for Attorney General. To learn more about her candidacy, go to MauraHealey.com. On Wednesday, we'll be joined by the other Democrat running for Attorney General. That's Warren Tolman. Thanks again, Maura, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Is the situation in Ferguson, Missouri, a moment or a movement? Could Michael Brown be the Emmett Till of the 21st century? Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price join us for that conversation next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3, as they are on Mondays, for All Revved Up, our syndicated columnist, Reverend Irene Monroe, and Reverend Emmett Price, who is also a professor of music at Northeastern University. We've missed you guys. Good to see you again.
Hey, glad to be back.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much for being here. Well, we're going to start in kind of a tough, sad note. The funeral service for Michael Brown is going on even as we speak. At least it was going on up until a few minutes ago. And he, of course, was the 18-year-old young man that was shot six times out in Ferguson, Missouri. We have many of these cases that get everybody all upset at the injustice and the unarmed black man and the white police officer. We've had these many times before. So is this case going to change anything, Emmett, or is it just going to be everybody's upset for a few weeks, everybody talks about this was terrible, and then business as usual?
Well, it will change something in the meta-narrative, but in the – I mean, it'll change, but unfortunately it won't be the game changer. Until majority America, you know, however you want to define that, feels the trauma – of having their young children murdered by civil servants. I think, you know, sympathy is one thing, but until you feel that trauma, I don't think things change, because part of the issue is the privilege, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
You have privilege issues, and until folks are willing to take the vision statement for America, which I look at as the Pledge of Allegiance, right? One nation, right? And you can deal with the under God piece if you want to, but indivisible, right, with liberty and justice for all, until we manifest that vision, there's a privilege aspect. And until we mitigate that and create equality for all, you know, we're not going to get there.
But you know what? I don't feel that we need a we in order to do that. I think that when we think about the civil rights movement, it really was the mover and shakers of a small group of people. So I really think that we can take this moment and make it into a movement. And I think that there's some changes that we can do, particularly since we have always had the policing of black people. I always feel for some reason we're still fighting what I call the Dred Scott decision of 1857 that said, where the Supreme Court said that African Americans, whether they were freed or slave, didn't have a right to citizenship. And I think that when you see Baghdad, USA, on the streets of Ferguson, it highlights that. But there are steps that definitely we can do. One that is that I think you have a better police force when it comes out of your community. So when we talk about and when we have diversity, it has to be more than just window changing. You really have to change policy. But one of the things that we don't get at, and I think that this would be a wonderful way to begin to open up a discourse about race, is to talk about implicit racism. Now, clearly with Ferguson, we did see some sort of Bull Connors rabid racist. But for the most part, most people are not that bad, unless they're Donald Sterling, of course. But when I say implicit racism, we are bombarded with an iconography of images that black is negative and that white is positive. Classic example is that they sort of did a retesting of the Brown versus Board of Education of black dolls and white dolls. And surprisingly, even in 2007, we had even black kids today saying that the black doll, they didn't even experience cognitive dissonance, that the black doll is negative. So I really think that we got to really address implicit racism.
Yeah, but let's assume we do have to address that. I assume virtually no one could deny, no matter where they are on this case, but the fact that we need to and should. And the underlying thing that Marjorie was raising with Emmett is there was a piece in the Washington Post yesterday saying this is another Emmett Till. This is a game changer. This is not going to be one of these things where we're aghast for a few days or a few weeks or maybe even a few months and move on. But what's the evidence that this really will be any different come a month from now, even if a grand jury that's meeting doesn't indict this police officer? Why should this one be – will this one be different?
I think that when you have a Republican from Kentucky, Rand Paul, who said – that clearly if he were a teenager, clearly he would have smarted off with the police officer, but he would never, ever think that it would result in, you know, his death. So I think that it outrages a whole lot of other
people.
Yeah,
but he's the outlier. This New York Times poll, which was stunning to me, but I know that probably both of you are going to say, why were you stunned? 18% of whites across America felt that the shooting was not justified. This is about a week ago, so obviously more has come out. But arguably, 18% of whites said it was not justified. 57% of blacks said it was not justified. So never the twain shall meet, at least on these kinds of issues, Emmett.
I mean, it 2 months from now, we're going to be struggling to remember Mike Brown's name, right? Oscar Grant. We can list the names, but people didn't remember Oscar Grant's name until the movie Fruitvale Station came out. People are already forgetting Eric Garner's name.
Tell people about Oscar Grant.
Oscar Grant was murdered in a MBTA train station out in the Bay Area, at the Fruitvale train station, after a night with his friends. They took the train to be safe, ironically, and there was a little tussle in the train. And afterwards, as the police were looking for who it was, they had him, and he was on the ground. He was on the ground and basically got murdered there. I mean, so the fact is that until those numbers come into parity,
those polling numbers come into parity,
there's still this kind of, it's not us, it's not in our neighborhood, it's not our children, so thus we don't care mentality.
But see, my point is that I don't think we have to wait for that particular demographic group to change.
Americans or African Americans?
We white Americans. Okay. I don't think that we have to, we need to worry about that. I think that we need to work at policy changes in terms of the police force. We need to demilitarize the police. I really think that in terms of black leadership, I mean, there's one moment that we can really pull from the page of the civil rights movement. We have to have an infrastructure within our black leadership. It's a shame. I have to say, it's really a shame that we pull leaders back from 1960s and 70s, like my buddy Al Sharpton or Jesse Jackson.
He was sitting in the front of the church this morning.
Oh, absolutely.
By the way, this is her high school classmate, if you weren't listening. it is what it is. Mm-hmm. A few weeks ago when you mentioned you went to school with him. But go ahead.
And so I think that what happens is that once we can really, really have a substantial leadership on this within our community. I mean, the civil rights movement started because of Emmett Till.
Right.
But when Rosa Parks got arrested, you know, as I say, King could not have stood up until she sat down. Yeah. We need one of those kinds of moments.
Yeah, but I think the we is much broader because there is no monolithic or homogenous African-American community, right? I mean, there's all shapes, sizes, different hues, different thought
ideologies
and whatnot.
Absolutely, but one of the things is this, though, Emmett. Whether you come from, wherever you come from the African diaspora, whether it's the West Indies, the motherland itself, Europe, or just down the block, Black is criminalized within an American context.
Right, but there's a difference between a local leader from Ferguson standing up and leading the people of Ferguson versus importing a national figure who is a media operative
well,
to come
what,
in.
Like, you know, Sharpton, you know.
Exactly.
Okay, right, absolutely.
Okay. So there's a distinction there in terms of who the we are, and I think in many of these different areas, there has to be the local, the same way that you speak of the local policing, there has to be the local leadership that rises up and takes essentially the lead of the people there as opposed to these importing of leaders.
Well, that's sad because they're disenfranchised. I mean, even when we look at the grand the jury, that composition now, we have 9 whites and 3 blacks, as we understand about the police force. Out of 53 police officers in Ferguson, only 3 are African Americans.
Yeah, but the cop who's been brought in, who has brought relative calm, who has received praise from virtually everybody around, this guy from the Highway Patrol,
is
an African American, Johnson, who has gotten a lot of praise from everybody.
We're talking with Irene Monroe and Emmett Price about this shooting of Michael Brown in Ferguson. You know, I wonder if you think there's something called Black Twitter, and if the role of social media might make this different. I mean, we do tend to forget things that we're all revved up on. About other stuff, but that's a possibility, maybe, of getting somewhere more on this one.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the old adage, you know, back in the 70s is the revolution will not be televised.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, it is being Twitterized, right? And when you take to Twitter for the revolution, then you don't have the right boots on the ground. So there's this divisive sense where you move everything social media, where people are fighting from the couches and fighting from, you know, from you know, the front seat of their cars as they're traveling across the nation. There's a distinction in terms of having the people who are on the ground to feel the sentiment and to feel the sensitivity of the mood in the moment. It's easy to punch in a couple of things on your PDA or your iPod or whatnot and then blast it out. But when you're there, right, and when your eyes are watering from the tear gas, there's a different sensibility that you have in terms of your
in terms
of the urgency and the sensitivity and the survival aspect of it.
Tell people about respectability politics. I was reading about this in terms of Ferguson too. You know what that means?
Well, yeah, I mean, it means a lot of things to a lot of people.
The analogy was Martin Luther King went to jail in a suit.
That's
and
right.
The idea that a lot of kids now, they got the pants down.
Right.
And they
so you have a widespread among blacks as well as whites that the hairstyle, the clothing, the music, the speech, it doesn't engender a sense of respectability.
Right.
But can I just say this, though?
Certainly.
Because, you know, and I'm going to use Emmett as an example.
Emmett
is an example of black respectability, of that those people who are talking about respectability. Emmett was coming home just recently from Connecticut with his wife, 2 children, and father-in-law in this car. And he got stopped only because he was driving while black. This is a college professor. You can't look anymore.
Unless you're Eric Holder, who's been stopped twice, who's the Attorney General of the United States.
We should hear it from the horse's mouth.
That's right. That's
what happened.
It's a true story. Stopped and pulled over, and because of my training over the years, now this has been happening to me since I was 12, you know, because I lived in the inner city of Los Angeles, and my parents pulled me out of public schools and sent me to a private school in North Hollywood. And so I learned at an early age.
At the time when the cops were there and were notoriously racist.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. During the Daryl Gates period, right?
Okay.
And I learned when the cops pull me over or grab me when I'm walking, put your hands up, right? and always address yourself. So my father taught me, when they say, what are you doing here? You say, my name is Emmett George Price III. My father's name is Emmett G. Price Jr. His phone number is this, you know, such and such. I'm walking from the bus stop to such and such school, which is at 3700 Coldwater Canyon, you know, and then you just do the liturgy.
That's
you know?
Right.
Because the question is, if there was a robbery right there, the police would often say, well, if you fess up to what you just did, we'll leave you alone. Or if you fess up, then we won't X, Y, and Z. So my father, from the age of 11, 12, taught me that my name is such and such, and I had my ID card. And before I could put my hand in my pocket, I had to address that I'm reaching in my left back pocket to get my wallet.
Okay.
In my wallet is my ID card. And so I've been dealing with that since I was 11 or 12.
And
so it's no thing to me at this
point.
That's
right. And I said to Emmett when he started coming here, I said, Emmett, why do you dress up all the time? I said, we only on for a few moments. He said, I can't afford to not.
Well, get back to what happened to you on the car.
Well, this time, you know, my wife is sitting back, my father-in-law's in the back, my kids are in the car. And so the police comes over, and I say, you know, my hands are on the steering wheel. He asked me for registration and license.
This is on the highway, by the way? Where were
this
you?
This is, we had gotten to Framingham, where I live. So we're in Framingham on the streets.
On the city?
On the city. Okay. Town streets. And so I said, I'm going to take my left hand and roll down my window, pushing the button. I said, my license and my registration are in the glove department. I'm going to reach over with my right hand, pull it out. And so, you know, he goes to his litany, well, what are you doing? I said, you know, sir, I said, I know you're on the clock. You know, I want to get out of your way. Let me know what we need to do. And so he looks in the back of the car, right? And so he sees my father-in-law sitting here, you know, this 70-year-old gentleman, you know, dressed very nicely as well, sees my children. And so he says, well, you have precious cargo in the van. And I said, indeed I do, right? No lipping, whatever. And so he says, well, here's, you know, please take care of your precious cargo.
Right. What were you allegedly stopped for?
Driving while black.
No, but allegedly stopped for.
Running a stop sign. How do you call it? A rolling stop.
Uh-huh. Yeah, rolling stop. Yeah. This is a white cop, I presume.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So then he said, see you later.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it was a successful, you know, thing. I'm happy, right? And there have been many times where it didn't go that way. But, you know, but it's for me, having done that for the last 30 years of my life.
Now, how much does that tick you off?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trained for it not to tick me off,
yeah,
though, right? But if I was not trained and had 30 years of experience of this,
it'll look like Ferguson.
It would look very much like Ferguson. It really would.
You know, speaking of Ferguson, we're talking Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. Irene, starting with you, start almost immediately after this shooting. We read stories. We saw a demonstration of whites in Ferguson, small demonstration, who were there in favor of the officer. We also saw that more fundraising has gone on for an officer who hasn't even been charged with anything that has gone to the Brown family and any money that they're raising on that side. But what a lot of conservatives said almost immediately, okay, Barack Obama spoke about this. How come Barack Obama doesn't speak about blacks killing blacks, like in Chicago? We all know the numbers now. They are greater. There are more deaths in Chicago than Americans have died in Afghanistan in a similar period. And my initial reaction was to say, God, they always look at any basis for criticism. But then I stepped back and I said, well, wait a second. Why isn't there some legitimacy in the criticism of, sure, it's fine for him to speak out in the case of Michael Brown or Trayvon Martin, but why haven't we heard more from the President of the United States on crime committed by blacks against blacks, which surely outnumbers these horrific situations like we've been talking about? What's the answer to that?
Interestingly enough, Obama did. Even when responding to Ferguson, he talked about how the police, you know, use excessive force. But he also talked about, you know, criminality among young black men.
No, but I believe he was talking about protesters. And unless I recall incorrectly, I thought he was talking about, even if you're upset about what happened in Ferguson, I'm paraphrasing, criminality is not defensible. I'm paraphrasing, obviously, is not defensible behavior. And I'm sure he has mentioned from time to time, but he hasn't singled out, except for that one kid who I believe was with the Obamas, that young girl in Chicago.
Right. Can't remember her name.
By the way, the fact that I can't remember her name is also significant.
Exactly.
I should say.
Right, exactly.
So, but isn't there some legitimacy in that? If one is concerned about young blacks in this country being murdered, they are being murdered at a far greater rate by people of the same skin color in their communities than they are by white police officers or Hispanic men in Florida or whatever it is.
But you don't see him addressing that with the program, his initiative, the Brothers Keeper?
It's an indirect approach at the problem, but it's not nearly as front-on or as frontal as this. So what's your take on this?
For me, Jim, this is one of a few things that I lament about his presidency, and I've been a supporter of President Obama. But I lament that in the post that he has and with the platform that he has, that we're not closer to this conversation that we've talked about week in and week out on race in the United States. And I think he's had the opportunity to initiate the conversation, even without taking a side perspective. He's been able to initiate the conversation, and we haven't had that.
Well, when he did, and it started really with Eric Holder, there was a lot of pushback around that. But I just want to say this in defense of Barack Obama is this. You know, he can't put out every fire. He did that with Skip Gates in 2009, and we saw what had happened. What will happen is that it's in a society that is so racially divided the way it is, if he spoke out about that, it becomes propaganda, if anything, for the right to use against Democrats, as well as to continue to demonize black male criminality.
Yeah, I agree that that's perhaps something that would happen. But again, I think the conversation is imperative for us to have, because you have to diminish this polemic that we have in the country.
We only have a minute. Can I interrupt only to say, in a second, we're going to ask callers. We're going to engage them and ask them about an issue that has gotten a lot of play in the last couple of weeks, is shortly after the President of the United States, same man we're talking about, gave what I thought was an incredibly powerful statement from Martha's Vineyard about what happened in Ferguson and the young man who was shot. Minutes later, he was on the golf course. And even those who, like me, said, the more a president wants a vacation, the better. He has the most stressful job in the world. He should cool out. Even people like me who are not in that camp, where they can't vacation, they have to be at the White House kind of thing, I thought that it wasn't just the case of optics, that it was really a poor decision not disinterest, but it made a statement that was inappropriate at that time. How'd you feel quickly, Emmett Price, about
that? Yeah, for me, it was none of our business where he went after the press conference.
So you were fine with it?
I think it's none of our business. You know what I mean? I mean, people deal with their stress in different ways, and it's none of our business to say what he should or shouldn't do. And if we didn't know, it wouldn't have been an issue.
That's a good point. Irene Monroe, how about you?
Well, no, I really felt that not only did the optics look bad, I mean, I think he has to realize that even though he's on vacation, he's representing the nation. So I just thought it looked very, very bad.
Turn the cameras off.
Okay. Well, you know, this is what I want to say in terms of the Ferguson thing. It's an old song that comes back of the 1960s called the Ella Baker song. Do you remember this? Where she says, "We who believe in freedom cannot rest until it comes, until the killing of black men, black mothers' sons is as important as the killing of white men, white mothers' sons." I hope that we will move as a nation towards that understanding.
Thank you, Irene.
That was terrific.
Thank you both.
Reverend Irene Monroe is a syndicated columnist. You can find her at the Huffington Post and Bay Windows. Reverend Emmett Price is a professor of music at Northeastern University. His latest book is The Black Church and Hip-Hop Culture Toward Bridging the Generational Divide. Thanks for coming in, you guys. As always, drive carefully, Emmett, on the way home. Coming up, what hath Goth wrought? We just talked about this with the two reverends. We're going to ask you. President Obama is getting criticized for hitting the links while the world falls apart. Is the criticism fair or not? Does the president deserve a break or doesn't he? We're going to ask you on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And now it's your turn. What do former Vice President Dick Cheney and left-leaning journalist Ezra Klein have in common? A shared antipathy for President Obama's penchant for golf. Last week, as you know, we've been talking about this with prior guests, the president held a press conference. This was on August 14th.
We lost a young man, Michael Brown, in heartbreaking and tragic circumstances. He was 18 years old. His family will never hold Michael in their arms again.
And that was the president. And shortly after that, he was on his way to play golf. Now, the president has been unilaterally scolded for, as Washington Post Dana Milbanks, I think, put it, vacationing as the world burns. We want to know where you are on this at 877-301-8970. And even if you are where I am, which is I want these people to vacation. They have the most stressful jobs in the world. If George Bush wants to go to the ranch, that's fine. If Barack Obama wants to go to Martha's Vineyard, that's fine. I want to focus more narrowly on the issue we just discussed with the two reverends at 877-301-8970. How about this whole image we had of the president, I thought, giving a very powerful statement about the death of Michael Brown. And then minutes later, we see photographs of him. On the golf course. Our number is 877-301-8970. My apologies, by the way. I'm confusing two stories. This is the sound here. The incident after which he went to the golf course was not the Brown thing. My apologies. This was
conference.
After the murder of the American journalist from New Hampshire, obviously. Foley, he said he'd be relentless against Islamic radicals, and then all of a sudden he was off to the golf course. My apologies for that mistake. We want to know, what was your reaction to this decision by the president? Is it just optics? Is essentially Reverend Emmett Price right that he should do whatever he wants to do after the press conference? I don't care what he does. Let him cool down in any way that he can. Or do you believe that this was something that made a statement that, as I do, that just didn't feel right following such a gruesome, horrific crime? 877-301-8970.
877-301-8970. I'm closer to where Emmett Price is on this one, because I think
a lot
of
this
is just political hypocrisy that, you know, people get up and if one more person says this, I'm going to go put my foot through the television set. Our thoughts and prayers are with so-and-so who've gone through the most recent horrific tragedy. No, your thoughts and prayers probably are not with those people. And to have this false,
was his statement false? Was his statement false?
No, he just talked to this young man's parents. He was on the phone with James Foley's parents. I think he was absolutely, truly devastated about what happened. I don't think, I guess, politically speaking, it probably would have been smarter for him to go in and hide in his house for the rest of the day.
It's not about hiding. To me, it's an issue of respect. You know what David Cameron, the prime minister of Britain, we mentioned before, canceled his vacation.
He canceled his vacation when one of the killers in the Foley case had a British accent, and they're doing further investigation on him. And that's fine. That's what he did, too. But this, to me, is just a constant kind of cheap thing that every time somebody picks up a golf club and goes out and golfs, you know, it's disrespectful. It's horrific. They shouldn't do it. George Bush, as we talked about before, stopped playing golf for the duration of the Iraq War.
Well, forget that. How about another George Bush situation? He makes a statement on a golf course about a suicide bomber in Israel. He's on the golf course in 2002. Here's what he says. Listen to George Bush.
We must stop the terror. I call upon all nations to do everything they can to stop these terrorist killers.
Thank you.
Now watch this drive.
What was your reaction to that? Thank you. Now watch this drive. Well, were you equally charitable to President George W. Bush?
Listen, you know, my father wasn't a politician, but I'll never forget going down when his brother, who was about 10 months older than he was, my father was a big golfer, walking into the house, and his brother had just died. And I said, gee, Daddy, I'm really sorry about your brother. He said, I know it's awful, but watch that chip shot by Lee Trevino coming up in the 18th hole. I mean, he's not a politician, so it's not a direct analogy. But I just think that there's this idea that everyone is supposed to go in, that the president is supposed to maintain this long face in public for as long as possible. What would it have achieved if he went into his house and played Scrabble with his daughters? Would that have been okay? Or if he watched a fun movie with his daughters and it was a comedy, would that have been disrespectful?
No, of course not. This
is all about this political showing. It's like the flags on everybody's lapel. If you don't wear a flag in your lapel and you're a politician, are you less of a patriotic politician?
I couldn't agree with you more.
Well,
in terms of the flag pin issue.
This was obviously different.
It was an affirmative statement, and it's not an affirmative state. If it turns out you go and you stay in your house and you have fun and you play, it's one thing. I mean, you heard what Emmett Price said. There should have been no cameras. And if there had been no cameras, then we wouldn't have known about him. And of course, I don't feel like I'm a hypocrite by saying if he had played golf and we hadn't known about it and had seen his, and the president does have a beautiful smile, whether you like him or can't stand him, he does have a beautiful smile. There was the juxtaposition with Cameron, the juxtaposition on one half of the screen with him giving this somber, beautiful statement. And then the other half half of the screen is him playing golf with his friends.
I think when you are the president of the United States, unfortunately, this particular situation was particularly gruesome, obviously, because it was a beheading and because these were foreigners attacking an American. But when you're the president of the United States, unfortunately, American citizens are being tortured and murdered in horrible ways all the time. So I don't have a problem with the guy on vacation going to play golf instead of doing – and you know what? He obviously doesn't either because he took all the criticism on Wednesday. He goes out and does play golf again on Thursday. He is not into that politics of wearing the lapel pin on his American flag, although I think he does.
He does now. Oh, yes, he does.
He does. But you know when he started doing that? Remember that during the
that
campaign?
That place in Iowa. There was a campaign
when
in 2008.
Hillary Clinton had one and he didn't.
Very well.
I would much rather vote for the person without the American flag on his lapel than the one who does because I think it's just pandering. Anyway, 877-301-8970. Let's start with Beth in North Andover. What do you think, Beth?
Hey, Beth.
Hello.
Hi.
I can't blame President Obama for going off and playing golf. Everyone needs to de-stress. They need a time to get over different things. And if you can compartmentalize the issues, get past it. And if he's doing the job he needs to when he needs to, what does it matter if he's running, playing golf, swimming, or water skiing?
Ah, well, I'm with you. I'm with you, Beth. I think he does need to de-stress. And he's sort of notoriously able to turn back the drama, the no drama Obama line we always hear about the president.
Hey, thank you, Beth, for your call. You know, Marjorie, I just thought of your best ammunition, a horrible choice of words against me.
What?
Why don't you say, hey, Jim, should he not have gone to the White House Correspondents' Dinner and laughed at Seth Meyers' jokes about Osama bin Laden when he had just authorized the strike on Osama bin Laden?
You know, Jim, it's a real tragedy. I didn't think about myself.
No,
you're absolutely right. That
and
was one of the most famous moments.
And I complimented him for his calm, his ability. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally, Seth Meyers was the host that year, wasn't he?
I think it was.
Meyers was making jokes about capturing Osama bin Laden. Obama is smiling. You say to yourself, you only learn after the fact, that he had just prior to that dinner authorized the raid on the compound where bin Laden was found. And I guess you could say the same thing.
So are you going to reverse your position now, Jim?
I'm going to try not to. Let's go to Jack here in Holden. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you much for your call, Jack. Hi.
Good morning. I'll try not to let the fact that I'm a golfer bias my comment.
Okay, Jack.
You know, Marjorie, I tend to agree with you. I mean, I was thinking about this even before you were speaking. And, you know, in retrospect, yeah, he picked a horrible time to take a vacation to Martha's Vineyard, but nobody could have predicted all these things happening. And he is on vacation, and I think he has a right to do what he wants to do on vacation. He has interrupted his vacation to go to Washington, you know, at least once, to my knowledge.
Yep, he has. Right.
So, you know, I mean, he's a guy on vacation. He happens to be the president, and there happened to be some horrible things happening, but I mean, I think he deserves some personal time on the golf course or with his family.
Well, you know, there's another
thing.
Thank you, Jack. You're also like walking around these 9 holes or 18 holes, however many holes you played, and it can be a very contemplative time as well. And we all talk about constantly how you need to take a break from the pressure to come back with a fresher view.
You definitely do.
I mean, he could have thought of a million things, a million brilliant strategies to combat what was going on over there while he was out there doing his chip shot out of the sand trap.
By the way, because I'm so charitable, because I haven't seen you in 17 days,
uh-huh.
I'm going to give you even more arguments.
Oh, gee.
As I'm sitting here, even though I haven't changed my position, I was totally appalled. Do you remember right prior to a midterm election when Bill Clinton was about to return to vacation? Where did he vacation virtually every year?
Martha's Vineyard.
Martha's Vineyard.
Right.
He's about to go to Martha's Vineyard. His pollster, Dick Morris, said, uh-uh, that's not right. People can't connect with someone going to Martha's Vineyard. What did he do?
I think he went to North Dakota or
something. He went camping in either Wyoming or Idaho, and Bill Clinton hated camping.
Oh, because it was
and
a
he
swing
did it because,
state?
No, because it was the kind of thing that the average person who was on the fence in the midterm elections was going to be for. There's
and
a great
the
piece.
Way,
Andy Barwitz, who's our favorite satirist.
Oh, we love him.
Barwitz Report writes today. I don't have it in front of me. Do you have it in front of
you?
What's the headline?
Critics blast Barack Obama for eating 3 meals a day while on vacation in Martha's Vineyard. It's really hysterical. Andy Barwitz, you don't know him. The whole thing is really a riot. And he said it was unconscionable with crises boiling over in Iraq, Syria, Ukraine, for him to be having breakfast, lunch, and dinner while on vacation. But the White House defended the president's eating habits, noting that his predecessor, George George W. Bush not only had breakfast, lunch, and dinner during the Iraq War, but he snuck in an afternoon snack as well. That, of course, is a joke. But anyway, the Borowitz report, if you haven't seen it, is absolutely hysterical. I think you don't like this, Jim, because you're not a golfer. I think the previous
caller
pointed this out, that you don't get the relaxing quality of being out there on the links.
Did I ever tell you that I got several holes in one at mini golf? Did you know that? I have. On Cape Cod, your second home. Let's go take one or two more. Tyler, you're in Marion. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Tyler.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for making it.
I'm fine with him going on vacation. Everybody needs a vacation every once in a while. But just like him taking it on the golf course, and when you brought it up, George W. Bush, I remember when I saw that that press conference when he had it on the golf course. I was like, you couldn't just not be at the golf course. You couldn't have done it somewhere else or done it at another time.
No, by the way, worse than the golf course was after making the statement, and he then in the same breath said, now watch this drive. I mean, there wasn't even separation, but go ahead, Tyler.
Yeah, and you know, I don't really blame him, but you don't want to show that you're having all this fun when all these bad things are happening as you're in that position up top. You know, you want to really show that you kind of care. And it shows that maybe obviously he does care, but it kind of shows him that maybe he doesn't care. It shows that he doesn't care a lot if he's there at the golf course when he's making this press conference about, you know. And I'm fine with him going to play golf. I live at the Cape, so Martha's Vineyard is a beautiful place, and I would want to go play golf there, too. But, you know, just take the press conference somewhere else, then go hit nine holes.
Tyler, thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
You remember George Bush the First when he used to speed golf out there? You know, they'd be in a golf cart and they'd fly around the golf course.
Now, is that true?
I think it normally takes, 3 to 4 hours to play 18 holes if you're in a foursome. And they would play like in 2 hours and 25 minutes something because they were flying from one hole to the next. And I'm wondering if he played golf during the whole, you know, Iraq invasion
the first time
around. I don't know either. And I didn't begrudge George Bush Jr., or George W. Bush, I should say. He was out there in the ranch all summer long either. Maybe he'd be out there you're getting rid of the brush all the time, and he got criticized for that because he took these very long vacations on the ranch. So what? It's like 2014.
I agree with you. No, you're missing. If I wasn't clear,
you're,
the vacationing,
you're stressing
I am 100%.
You're stressing the
golfing. No, not golfing in general. If that's what he does to relax, and he obviously does.
So let me ask you this.
Immediately after this press conference condemning the killers of James Foley.
What would have been a respectable interim of time?
One day. Yeah, I mean, by the way, and I know you could say, well, isn't that arbitrary? Should it be three? Of course it's arbitrary. The same day, and you know, I'll tell you why, because you understand a little bit about the news too, right?
Right.
Television that day had the split screen, as it's called, with him smiling, playing golf, and making the somber statement about Foley. That would have not been the case. And you may consider it hypocritical. You may say it's just optics. It sends a message that, in my opinion, undercuts what I think was his legitimate deep concern for both going after the terrorists and for the horrible death of this young man.
But yet again, think about the mass shootings that happen all the time in the United States of America. So, you know, this was a horrible, terrible, just brutal thing. But again,
did he go out and play golf the same day he did the press conference with the families about Newtown? Or we made a statement about Newtown?
Newtown happened in December.
Okay, so
maybe he would have been. Maybe he played basketball that day. We didn't know about it.
I don't know. We didn't know about it. That's exactly the key.
Okay, so if you do it in secret, knows about it.
As a matter of fact, the answer is yes. Yeah, the answer is yes. It's the public view. That is exactly correct. Now, you may consider that even more hypocritical.
I do.
Maybe it is.
Okay. Do you have any more arguments on my side?
No,
before we leave this topic?
I think I've given
you
enough.
So you can help me buttress my case here. Okay. Up next, we're going to ask you what it means to throw like a girl. Moni Davis puts a new spin on that phrase. The Boston Globe's Shira Springer joins us for that conversation next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Brady and Marjorie Egan. For a grim summer that we all know has been fraught with violence from Missouri to the Middle East, here is one of the truly brighter moments of the season.
Everyone, including those on the hill, on their feet. It's over! A complete game for Moni Davis.
For you, throwing like a girl means what? What's your fastball?
Throwing 70 miles an hour.
I'd throw him like a girl.
How great is that? That, of course, is the voice of 13-year-old star pitcher Monet Davis. First was the end of the game where she threw this two-hit shutout, and then was an interview on CBS News. Here with us in Studio 3 to talk about this Monet moment is Shira Springer. Shira, as you know, is an investigative and enterprise reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. Good to see you, Shira.
Good to see you.
Hi, Shira. So for people who have missed out on this little phenom, tell people who the Monet Davis is and why she's such a big deal.
Well, first of all, Monet Davis is a 13-year-old pitcher for the Tanny Dragons. I think that's the name of the team from Philadelphia. And she pitched in Little League World Series, as you heard there, complete game shutout, throws 70 miles per hour. For all those of you who are wondering what that means for an equivalent in the major leagues, that's a fastball in the low 90s.
Because of the distance.
Because of the distance, because the mound is closer in Little League. She also has a pretty darn good curveball. She was the first pitcher to female pitcher to win a game in the Little League World Series. And more than that, she has sort of started this or created this moment where people were really starting to take notice of what a girl, in quotes, can do up against the boys. And she really kind of captured a lot of people's imaginations. She was not only a role model or becoming a role model for young girls playing sports, but for also young boys. And a little creepily, for some older men who were chasing her around for autographs.
You know, but some people said that's creepy. What is creepy about an older man loving the fact
you
that this kid...
they're all pedophiles. You're
no,
always the
I'm
first
talking about some of the
say.
Coaches. No, but I thought that was terrific to see grown men who don't even understand the concept of rooting for not only a young woman, a girl. I love that. I didn't think it was creepy at all. You were kidding, right?
Well, she was the one who used the word creepy.
She did call
it creepy. She said it's a little creepy to have older men come up and ask for my autograph. I don't mind the fact that they're admiring her play and trying to get tickets to the games in which she pitched in.
They're probably planning on selling the autographs. That's probably
But one of the things that is so neat is that these kids are in the Little League World Series. These are some of the best players, obviously, in the whole world. And here she is, a 13-year-old girl.
Dominating
boys who are not at puberty yet, most of them, or at least a lot of them. And so she was the best in the world against the best in the world, and she's dominating.
Yeah, I mean, I think that is the big point. You know, she wasn't just out there, you know, getting maybe a bloop single or something like that. She was throwing, you know, 70 miles per hour, which is basically as fast as these little leaguers get with their fastballs. She was throwing complete games. Again, the shutout. I mean, she was impressive in what she could do on the field. And people weren't just saying, oh, look at the girl playing. They were saying, oh, look at a really high caliber athlete playing.
Yeah. They were, but I like everything in American life, there's always negativity. I mean, it's so many. I read a number of columns written mostly by women, maybe all by women, saying, yeah, but they're only celebrating her because she's playing in a boys' game. If she was that extraordinary in a girls' game, we'd never hear about her. Then they cite examples, which may have some truth to them, is the great athlete Billie Jean King. All the incredible matches against Navratilova were on one level, but when she played Bobby Riggs in this joke match, a man, obviously, but, you know, that was the thing that captured the attention of America. I have to say, I'm usually a cup half full, half empty kind of guy, but I am totally a cup fully full with this kid. Am I wrong?
No, I don't think you can. I think you can be both in this case, in this sense. I think you can appreciate what Monet Davis brought to the field, but I also think you do have to recognize the fact that in order for female athletes to get attention, still in this day and age, you have to be something of a novelty act. You have to, you know, play against the boys and dominate. And there are a lot of talented women out there who are playing baseball, who are playing softball, who are playing a variety of sports, who simply aren't getting noticed, who are at the caliber in their own respective sports, who are at the caliber of Monet Davis. And I think, you know, I'm glad, and it probably is all female columnists who are bringing this out, but I'm glad they are bringing attention to that, because there should be more attention paid to young female athletes, to female athletes in general, and they shouldn't have to be on a stage with boys and dominating boys to get the respect they deserve as athletes.
You know, what's a perfect example in your defense, I think, of your argument is Becky Hammon, who I cannot tell a lie, I never heard of, even though she was one of the great players in WNBA history, right?
Yes.
And when do I hear about her? When she's the first woman's coach to be paid and hired by the world champion San Antonio Spurs as an assistant coach.
Perfect example. I mean, this is a woman who, in her own right, as a player, as an all-star player, as one of the
premier players in the WNBA. I think she's had something like a 14 or 15 year long career in the WNBA, been an assist leader. I mean, she is the real deal as a player, but you're absolutely right. Doesn't get any attention until she becomes an assistant coach for the Spurs.
I hate to be Debbie Downer in this group here. We're talking to Shira Springer.
That's usually my role, isn't it?
But it is unfortunately true, and maybe there are some sports that it's not true in that will change in the future. But she is. I mean, I'm pretty tall, and I was as tall as I am now when I was 12, and I was bigger than all the boys. And then suddenly all the boys started growing when they're 15, and by the time boys are 15 and 16 and 17, you know, they're much more powerful. I have a daughter that played soccer for years, and she was a great soccer player. But I have to tell you, it was more exciting. It pains me to say this as a mother, to watch the boys' high school team than the girls' high school team, because they're more aggressive and they're tougher, and they're, for the most part, I don't want to say better athletes. Not better athletes.
They're different athletes.
They're different athletes. And so I get, in a way, why girls' sports, whether it's the WNBA or whether it's women's golf or whatever it is, doesn't get – because for the most part, the women are not better than the men. The men are still better. It pains me to say that.
See, and I would say you have to have sort of like a paradigm shift or a mind shift about what you define as better. They play
stronger, more
different.
Powerful.
Fine. But if you look at a woman's game, here's some of the things that I hear men saying about women playing, particularly, let's say, when I was at the gold medal game in women's ice hockey. They play a purer brand of ice hockey than the men do. Same thing is said about basketball. Now, they may not be playing above the rim, and they may not be as physical as the men, but there is a pureness to the passing and the teamwork and the way in which they play together that is different than the men's game. So maybe we as a society, and I'll just throw this out there, need to change the way we think about what is good sports. We can't, I mean, women will never be as strong, they will never run as fast, they will never be as physical. But if we, perhaps we look at them for what they are instead of for what they aren't, they might get more.
Well, there's
fans.
One exception I can think of, and you probably thought of a million more because you're a sports person. I like to watch women in the Olympics figure skating better than men. And I think that they look just as good, if not better than the men. Why are you laughing? Because it's a sexist sport in that sense?
Well, there's artistry there. Yeah. I think, you know, the women have the advantage with the artistry and they're more flexible and they can, you know, they may not be able to jump as high, but skating is about so much more than jumping.
Yeah.
High. I mean, I think a good comparison might be women's tennis. Women's tennis.
That's a great one.
Is a spectator sport that I think gets a lot of viewership.
Yeah.
And if there are good rivalries in the women's game, and when you have that one-on-one action and the serves are hard and the ground strokes are great ground strokes, I think when you're watching that as a spectator sport, I think it matches up well with the men's sport.
We're going to touch in a second on one more incredibly bright spot from the Little League World Series coming out of Rhode Island. But before we do, virtually every playing off what Marjorie said a minute ago, I was not aware until Marjorie told me and I read the Times today that the average 12-year-old girl is actually bigger and stronger than the
yes.
average 12-year-old boy.
But
they
faster.
Essentially, right, and they, I didn't.
Average 12-year-old girl is on average 3 inches taller
that
than the average male. I mean, like Marjorie was saying, they'll have their growth spurts yeah. later. And I don't want to take anything away from what Monet Davis did, but she is at something of a physical advantage compared to her,
right, and
her
that's
male counterpart.
So she's arguably, at least in as competing against boys is concerned, she may be at her athletic peak. So should I be upset when I'm saying to myself, and a lot of people have written about how upset they are, that probably the next time I'm going to read about her is in one of those great Sports Illustrateds, which I love, which say, where are they now? She's 33 years old. She's the athletic director at such and such a college in the Midwest, or maybe my hometown and hers in Philadelphia. Should we be upset about that or just celebrate the fact that as a 13-year-old, she made history? It was great.
I'm kind of upset about it. I think it's sad that, you know, she has stated that her big dream is to play at this point, to play basketball for the UConn women's team under Gino Auriemma. I would like to think that in, you know, 5-6 years, we see her starring for the UConn women's team and that the WNBA is at a point where it's getting a lot of attention and we're not doing the where are they now, but we know where Monet Davis is. But if I have a feeling there have been she's the 18th girl to play in the Little League
yeah.
World
yeah.
Series. I have a feeling that she will join the other 17, and they've done some retrospectives now that she's come, that Monet Davis is here. And you see that these women went on to play college softball. You know, they play in these recreational softball leagues now, and they are all Where are they now cases?
You know, it's unbelievable also, but then I want to leave this, is you just mentioned Auriemma, who's the male coach of the women's, probably the greatest college basketball team, women's basketball team in history. And this is horrible. And even though I have watched their games, I can't name one player on the team, even though I could in a minute. And I, of course, could name the male coach of the team. Let's switch to another incredibly bright spot. Listen to this sound. If you haven't heard it, you've got to hear it many a time. Here's Rhode Island's coach, Cumberland coach, Dave, I hope you pronounce it Belial, I'm not sure, gives his team a post-game pep talk after they were eliminated from Little League World Series. Listen to this.
You guys are going to bring back something, okay, that no other team can provide but you guys. That's pride, okay? Pride. You're going to take that for the rest of your life, what you provided for a town in Cumberland. You had the whole place jumping, right? You had the whole state jumping. You had New England jumping. Yeah, you had ESPN jumping, okay? Because want to know why? They like fighters.
And if I'm not wrong, didn't he, after that beautiful speech, ask them all to come hug him?
Yep.
Did he not?
Yes. Come for a hug. He told him this was his best memory as, you know, a coach and an athlete.
Yeah. How beautiful is that?
How beautiful and how important to hear that. And I'm so glad it went viral because we are living, unfortunately, in a time when you hear far too many stories about coaches either taking advantage of their athletes and using them as sort of cash cows or treating them like pieces of meat to advance their own
Even
kids' coaches to advance their own coaching careers to go from AAU to the high school level to the college level. Or even worse, you hear about those cases where there's improper sexual conduct between coaches and their players. And to see that you can have a youth coach that is doing everything right and sending the right message is really important.
Yeah, he's absolutely terrific. He ends it by saying, you give me the most precious moment of my athletic and coaching career. I've been coaching for a long time, getting to be an old man. I need memories like this. You're all my boys. You're the boys of summer.
Oh, my God!
I know.
You can't script it any better.
Tears. Oh, I'm crying.
There's a movie in there somewhere. How come you're not going down to Cumberland to be writing about it? This is right up your alley, isn't it?
I would love to go down to Cumberland, but there's another baseball team in town that's barely pulling my attention away.
Okay.
Before you go, you ever been to a Little League World Series?
I have not. I have jogged around, you know, fields here where Little League games have going on, and they're always quite enthusiastic.
One more sport. Ice skating, you mentioned tennis. Anything else women have a chance? How about running?
I think running,
long-distance
too.
Running.
I think you can even go so far as to make a generalization where individual sports, women tend to fare better because they're more recognizable. You can focus on the individual.
Marathoning. Here was huge.
Yeah. And okay, Shira Springer.
Shira, it's great to
see
you as always.
Hope Springs Eternal. She's an investigative and enterprise reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. Shira, thanks for being here,
as always.
Thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow. You get open mic with Nancy Kane and Charlie Sennett, who heads up Ground Truth Project and co-founded Global Post. He'll talk to us about the latest developments in the Middle East. Our show is a production of WGBH Boston Public Radio. Chelsea Murs, Will Roslip, Amanda McGowan are our team. John Parker and Alan Mattis are our engineers. I am Marjorie Egan.
I am Jim Brody. Welcome back.
I know. We're back.
We are back.
I'm very glad to be here, Jim.
So am I.
Thank you very much. See you later. Thank you very much for listening. Please tune in again tomorrow.